Hi everybody, sorry about that false start earlier, just can't read very well. It's really nice to be back here and to see some familiar faces. I reckon it's probably about 10 years ago that we must have last been here. I think we came and shared some thoughts with you guys just after we'd got back from Afghanistan. So just by way of context, I checked my diary this morning and it's 10 years and a month that we as a family returned from Afghanistan. And we'd worked there since 1999 and raised our kids there and been through, in retrospect, quite a few stressful experiences in that time. Since then, over the last 10 years, Julie's worked mainly as a counsellor in various settings and I continued working in crisis locations for a few years and then probably about 3 years ago started getting involved in Indigenous work in the communities in the deserts. And then these days I'm head of a large consulting firm called SALT, which actually is really just me. It's just you try to make it look bigger by calling yourself the principal, which is another way of just saying you're the only employee. And in that work I'm helping some Aboriginal communities still and doing a bit of work with some international aid organisations as well. So there's a group in Mongolia I was privileged to go and help out with a while ago. First time I've been to Mongolia and that was pretty interesting. And I'm also doing some work up in Roeburn, the Injibandi people and Yarranjara mob who are out near Fitzroy. Or actually, their country is south of Fitzroy, but I'm doing those kinds of things. And of course, we're just continuing to be parents and go to our church, which is St Barnabas in Leaderville. And that brings me to the kind of theme that I wanted to explore today, which is a durable faith or a faith that endures. Or the longer title that I wanted to give this message was Traversing the Long Flat Plains of Middle Age Christian Life. Which gives you a clue to where we're going. And I have to say, it took me ages to prepare this message. Normally, getting a sermon together comes very easily to me, and there's something that I feel pressed about to talk about. But it took a long time for this to coalesce, so apologies if it's perhaps in some ways still quite unfinished. But I think I've been able to understand why it took so long, because of that experience that I find myself in, of this sort of long, flat walk over the empty plains of middle-age Christian life. There's no real highs and lows, none of the sharp edges that marked our earlier years when we were in Afghanistan. It's not super interesting or exciting. No one asks me to speak at conferences anymore. I haven't been on the radio for ages. No one asks my opinion on Afghanistan, so I just have to give it whether they want it or not. But I guess on the flip side, no one's shooting at us. And, you know, we haven't had to deal with kidnappings and the kids haven't had to go to safe rooms. So there's pros and cons to where we are now. This long, flat walk, I don't know if that resonates with anybody. The problem with long, flat walks is they're kind of boring. And this experience seems to be true for a number of my Christian peers, some of whom I meet with on a regular basis, and we talk about how we're going. Some of the guys I knew in early years with TIA or Scripture Union or Christian youth work or in mission work seem to have mellowed a bit and, in their own words, grown a bit bored with church. The popular term for this seems to be to call yourself a church refugee. And I've heard that term, and I'm not sure if I like it or if I think it's valid. I've heard things like, it's just not working for me. I'm enjoying the break. In some cases, this break has been going on for several years. I'm seeking God outside the church. Fair enough, God is obviously not just within the church. I'm needing some space from the church experience. I just sort of stopped going. And some people I know are seeking to explore their faith in other ways. Wisdom experiences. Some are working really hard to build a better superannuation, which actually might have something to it now that I think about it. And some are sort of leaving church altogether. Now, my friends would still call themselves Christians, but the rhythm and the texture of that Christian life suggests perhaps their faith has moved into a different and perhaps less prominent place. And I've done my share of that, for sure. So it's less that I'm standing here in judgment of that experience and more trying to understand what it is that drives this and how we press on along this long, flat journey. So I'm trying to make sense of this as I read the Bible in the mornings, which I mostly try to, and as I go to church each Sunday and meet with the same group of people, some of whom you get heartily sick of, the same rhythms, as I said, the absence of highs and lows. And I'm sure we've all experienced and understand that, you know, the longer you walk as a Christian, the more disappointments, hurts and pain and difficulty you accrue. You hurt people and you are hurt by them. People die, people we love. People become ill and sometimes permanently so, and a decline begins. And the sorrow of all of this can be disabling. Things don't work out, ventures fail, conflicts linger and flare up and never resolve. We continue to sin in great ways and in small. And things we hoped for that would change in ourselves remain stubbornly present. And even in, Julian, our own experience of Afghanistan, as I'm sure you know, having worked there through whilst the Taliban was still there, and then the fall of the Taliban, and then those years in the early 2000s, only to see last year in August the Taliban version 2.0 emerge, there's this sense of us, or at least for me, of thinking, what was that all about? So we continue in these rhythms that, you know, almost repeat themselves sometimes, and you know, church itself can be a frustrating and perhaps boring experience. There's only so many times you can hear the same old pastor preach without wanting to slap him or her hard about the head. Or perhaps that's just me. And, you know, sometimes you've got to put up with some visiting preacher, some worn-out old aid worker come and present a message that doesn't appear to be going anywhere. So persevering is hard. Well, I've been reading the end of John's Gospel recently and spent quite some time thinking about and trying to put myself into the experience of the disciples at this really quite dynamic period where Jesus was handed over, killed, buried, disappears from the grave. Before he appears to the disciples, the grave is empty, he appears to the disciples several times, and then, you know, there's the 40 days where he's present with them in some form or other, teaching, and obviously then ascends to heaven. I've been trying to put myself in that experience to see what I might learn from it. And there's a few things that have emerged for me which I'd like to reflect on. So let's just revisit those passages. In John 20, starting at around verse 19, a few disciples are together in a room and the doors are locked. And it says, for fear of the Jews. Events have rattled them. You know, they've had this comprehensive teaching earlier towards the end of John about what's going to happen. And I will say Jesus is not always as straightforward as he could be, sometimes a little bit oblique and opaque in his meaning. But he has tried to convey to them what's going to happen. And they've already seen that he's gone from the grave, and it says Peter saw and believed, although what he believed we're not exactly clear on. So despite everything they've heard, they are confused and lost and fearful. And Jesus comes in uninvited and stands with them. He doesn't give them a choice, he just shows up. And he shows them his wounds. And he breathes on them and says, receive the Holy Spirit, and calls them to action. That's the first time. Now, Thomas, who I have to say I quite like, says, well, it's not good enough for me to hear it from you guys. I want to see him. Well, a few days later, 8 days, Jesus comes and stands with them again. And he says to Thomas, put your finger here. See my hands. Put out your hand and place it into my side. Don't put it on my side. Place it into the wound. It's intimate. It's awful even to think of doing that. And Thomas believes. So he's had an experience, and cognitively and experientially he believes. He believes something. Again, we're not exactly sure what that belief means, but surely it was a powerful experience, right? But somehow the disciples still don't get it. This experience is not yet impelling them forward. They don't have drive or clarity about what it means. And I can imagine them saying something like, I'm actually sure, not sure what's happening. I mean, Jesus goes again, and I can imagine them kind of going, so what was that all about? You know, I imagine them trying to debrief it. You know, what happened? So what did it mean? Now what do we do? You know, the old what now, so what now what thing. And Peter says, I don't know, I'm going fishing. And they say, we'll go with you. They revert to type, fishing something they know. They go back to doing something they know that's presumably at some level rewarding or at least habitual. And off they go. I'm not sure what's happening. This isn't working. I'm going fishing. Anyone want to come? They go and they fish for a while and it's disappointing. Well, they're fishermen. Presumably they're used to that. There must be, you know, many times where they haven't had much of a catch and they catch nothing. And I'm trying now to imagine the conversation here. And don't forget, in the boat are both Peter and Thomas, both of whom have just seen Jesus, heard him, touched him. They're there in the boat. What's happening? I can imagine the conversation. This is hopeless. What are we doing here anyway? What are we meant to do? Where is Jesus? What was he on about? Is he back or isn't he? Well, we saw him, didn't we? Yeah, but I don't know. He said he was sending us, like, go out and forgive people. Yeah, but what are we meant to do? What does that look like? And in the midst of this, this guy calls out from the shore, you caught anything? Now, I've done a bit of fishing and mostly unsuccessful, frequently, in fact. And it's often annoying to have someone call out to you and give you advice while you're fishing. Why don't you try over there? Oh, you're using the wrong bait. Oh, you're using muleys. You should be using, I don't know, something else. Now, they could have ignored this bloke on the beach. They didn't know it was Jesus. They could have ignored him and thought, who are you, mate? Get lost. That would have been understandable. They're the professionals after all. It's their work. They're discouraged. But Jesus invites them to do something different, and they respond. They could have refused. We can always refuse to respond to Jesus. But they responded. They said, okay. And we know what happens. They catch tons of fish. They suddenly click that this guy is Jesus. They go in, they have brekkie, they talk together, and this connection is strengthened, and sustenance, physical and presumably spiritual. And later, specific instruction from Jesus. The relationship between Jesus and Peter is restored. There's that interchange where Peter essentially forgives, where Jesus essentially forgives Peter and calls him into a new relationship with him. And then later the Holy Spirit comes and all of that. All of that does come later, but it begins in a sense with them responding. So the point, I think, is this. Sometimes Jesus chases us down. He comes into the room uninvited and says, put your hand in me. Forces almost an intimacy. But other times he waits at a distance and quietly calls out to us, asking perhaps an oblique question. And we can always ignore, turn away, refuse. Jesus will ask again. It's not a one-off invitation. But, and from my own experience, I know that the more we ignore or distance ourselves or refuse to respond, the more that habit builds. And the converse is true. The more we say yes, the stronger that response becomes. I don't think it becomes easier to respond to Jesus, but I think the response becomes stronger. There's a difference. Well, as I was preparing the sermon, I came across this quote from C.S. Lewis. And typical C.S. Lewis, he doesn't soften the blow. This is from Mere Christianity, and I'd like to read it to you. Christ says, "Give me all. I don't want so much of your time and so much of your money and so much of your work. I want you. I have not come to torment your natural self, but to kill it. No half measures are any good. I don't want to cut off a branch here and a branch there. I want to have the whole tree down. I don't want to drill the tooth or crown it or stop it, but to pull it out. Hand over the whole natural self, all the desires which you think innocent, as well as the ones that you know are wicked, the whole outfit. I will give you a new self instead. In fact, I will give you myself. My own self will become yours." Now, this is a strong message. And in some ways, it's an easier message to hear when you're young. Feels like that to me. Feels like I could say, yeah, we did that. We gave our whole lives over to Jesus, Julie and I. We took him at his word when we were married and the decisions that we took following that, in what we did in our decisions about going overseas. We went to a hard place. We did the math. We gave it to him. And that feels true. I don't feel like I'm kidding myself on that. But here's the real challenge, is that Jesus is still asking that of us. He's still asking that of me. Later in this passage from Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis uses the example of a field of weeds, extending the metaphor. He says, "For this field of weeds to produce wheat, it all must be torn up. You can't sow the wheat amongst the weeds. The whole thing must be torn up and ploughed. And not just once. Every year that has to happen. Every farmer knows that. Sometimes twice a year, perhaps." So this is what Christ seems to be asking of me, sometimes loudly and sometimes quietly. There's this invitation to join him that he repeats and repeats and repeats, to give ourselves over to him. And our response must not be just once, but yearly, monthly, weekly, daily, and sometimes hourly. So this durable faith, this faith which endures, does so because of our frequent, regular strengthening of the yes response. In spite of loss and sadness and disappointment and years where there is no crop or years of drought and storm, empty years, Jesus doesn't want us to turn to other pursuits or to cease the habits and the rhythms of the Christian life, but to continue, even over these long, flat plains, to continue practicing the quiet, discipled, and sacrificing life. Well, just to turn briefly to the second reading, the cost of discipleship, I won't read the whole thing. We're pretty familiar with some of these strong claims that Jesus makes, and obviously which inform C.S. Lewis's passage. But I just wanted to pull out one sentence or a couple of sentences from the middle of that passage of where Jesus teaches on the cost of discipleship. Jesus says, "Which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it will begin to mock, saying, 'Ah, you began to build and you haven't finished it.'" How do we hear these words from Luke, from Jesus in Luke? Typically strong, polemic words. But if we just sort of look at them perhaps less polemically, we know actually you can't really count the cost when you're starting out. It sounds good, but you can't count the cost of the long Christian life at the outset. You've no idea what you're in for. If I'd known what I was in for when we went to Afghanistan, would we have gone? Probably not. You know, it's not that uncommon that someone starts to build a house and there's massive budget blowouts. Who hasn't had that experience? If you ever watch that show, it's called Grand Designs. You know, all the time people are building a house and they budget $1 million. Halfway through, the presenter says, "What's your budget now?" "3 million. And I mean, it's a folly sometimes to keep building these things, but they do. They complete them, mostly. So I don't think it's so much of a problem if it takes a lot longer to build your house, to use that metaphor, to build a tower, or if there's this long period in the middle where not much gets done. You know, the exciting bit is the design, and then they start off, and then there's this long period where it slowly builds, and then it's even longer before you actually get to move in. But I don't think it matters if that long period in the middle of building takes a long time or ceases. I just think we've got to keep building. You've got to keep pressing towards completion. Amen. I did want to leave some time for anybody to reflect, give comments or thoughts, and whether that is an experience or a reflection that resonates for people. So I know there's a mic there, and if you want to say something, I'm not quite sure how it works here, but feel free. I did parenthetically call in my own mind this sermon "The Long Defeat." And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Sarah Grove song, "The Long Defeat," but she's a Christian singer-songwriter, and she has a song that I think is quite beautiful, and I recommend it to you, called "The Long Defeat." And in it, it begins, I think, by saying, "I have joined the long defeat." And she's talking about the Christian life, that it is, in a sense, a long defeat. It's an accumulation of sorrows and pain and wounds and hurts. But what marks it is not success, but endurance. And we know that, although it may look like a defeat to the rest of the world, we know that it's not. So that's just a song to chase up when you go home. It's deeply encouraging despite its discouraging title.
I feel a bit sad that you seem to feel like that at the moment. I'd like to hear more about what you've done with Indigenous communities, because Peter and I passed through Fitzroy Crossing a few weeks back. We weren't there very long, but I would say it's the most hopeless town I've ever seen in my life, and I think that anything that anybody could do there that was positive and uplifting would be worthwhile, and it would be exciting to be able to think you could contribute in that way. So I don't know whether you can talk to me more about that.
I hope I haven't given the wrong impression of myself feeling discouraged, because I actually feel pretty good about where I'm at in this sort of long plane. It's just different. But very briefly on some of the work with the Yanunjara mob, their country is actually well south of Fitzroy, and it's a very big determination, a native title determination. I'm not sure if anybody here knows about the Noora Canvas, but when Yanunjara people were preparing their native title, in addition to proving before the tribunals or the courts their long connection to country, some of the older people got together and said, "Well, we don't really do this written legal stuff. We paint." And they painted the Noora canvas, which is enormous. It's probably a third the size of this room. And it paints their connection to country. It tells their story over centuries, millennia, of how they relate to country. And it was a critical piece of evidence, or of proof, I suppose, in their native title claim. And it's a extraordinarily beautiful canvas. And I, again, please look at it. But that's part of Yananjara Mob's story. And the CEO there, a guy called Pete Murray, who I'm working with, they don't have any mining leases or mining royalties currently in place on their country. So they're not a well-resourced group. But one of the things they do want to do, and I think this is pretty encouraging, is they want to establish different income streams for their people that aren't hinged to mining royalties, so that they can actually build their own future rather than one that's determined by the boom and bust relationships with mining, which is what... You know, it's been called the kind of resource curse, because a lot of indigenous mobs are pretty well off, comparatively speaking, because of their mining royalties. But what they've found is that mining then tends to call the shots. And there's terrible cost to their country. Access is an issue, getting back on country. So it's quite inspiring to be working with Yananjara, although not having much money is a tough one, but that's one of the things we're working on with them. But you're right, Fitzroy's a tough place. And one of the things they want to do is move their offices back onto country several hours south of there.
What about this canvas now?
The canvas, I wouldn't believe the story if I hadn't heard it. The Shah of Oman, some oil billionaire, is a guy who really loves indigenous art. And he saw this canvas somehow and has taken an interest in it, and flew it over to Oman to have it displayed, and now wants to enter into a partnership with Yananjara to build a community, like an art centre, on Yananjara country to display the Noora canvas. So currently I think the Noora canvas is with the canvas committee somewhere in their offices in Fitzroy. But there's this bizarre experience I have of talking to Pete Murray, this senior Yananjara man. He says, yeah, I was talking to the Shah the other day and the Princess of Oman is flying into Darwin next week and we're going up to meet her to talk about funding options for the canvas. I'm just thinking, how do these two cultures possibly connect apart from having lots of desert? But anyway.
Phil, just going back to the passage and perhaps that paradox that you just described is also reflected in the passage of people who are scared, frightened, defeated, under threat, and they're told that if they forgive somebody, then God forgives them. In other words, you are now God, if you like. You are doing what God does. How powerful is that? Mm. And the heaviness of that is if you don't forgive someone, they'll remain unforgiven. You've actually got this power. I'm not asking you to take anyone to the temple or to refer them to me. I'm asking you to... So, yeah, and it's in their moment of abject, if you like, defeat that happens in their hiding place.
Yeah.
I thanks, Bevan, for letting me read that, because I was reflecting as I was reading it. But, yeah, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I think there's this strange experience we have of Christians of both being fully forgiven and given this great mission and knowing that, and then you see it in the disciples. They know it cognitively. You know, Simon Peter says, I believe, and Thomas says, I believe. And they've had this great cognitive experience, but sort of empirically at a kind of experiential level, they struggle to live that out. And they do struggle. You know, the story of Acts is full of that. But that's the imperfect nature of this mission that we're called into. And it's quite a beautiful thing that in such broken vessels as we are, still hold this fantastic life-giving water. It's quite amazing.
Firstly, thanks, Phil, for in response to what you were talking about with Bobby about the flatness after the excitement, if you will. That's been really quite helpful to hear and to see, or to hear you talk about landing after 10 years of all of that, because I was aware of you and what you were doing and the shackles and whatnot back in those times. And it was so amazing and so different from any life that I could ever imagine for myself. And then I wonder, gee, what happens after that? How do you live after that? But I do echo the middle age. This is just it feels flat in a way, but I'm drawn to a topic of humility that I can see in your description of yourself there. That humility, not as seeing myself as less than or poor or bad or whatever, but seeing myself for who I really am. And yes, this is the life I'm experiencing now. And thanks for that description.
Thank you. Yeah, I was going to wear my humility badge, but I couldn't find it. But it is a curious thing that Julie and I have both reflected on about, we were people in Afghanistan. We were, we were known, that was our thing. And, you can still Google my name and it's, it comes up with that sort of historical story. But, coming down from that into the ordinary rhythms is a tough one. But I actually think there's I'm going to hesitate to say richness, but there's a goodness in that. And probably a richness that you only find when you just keep going, And that's all right. I'm feeling all right about that. I'll leave it there, and we'll look forward to chatting with you a bit after the service as well. Thank you.